Right now on the Daily Debrief, a former NFL player faces accusations of sex crimes, plus...
It was blow after blow after blow to a child's skull.
Prosecutors wrap up their case against a man accused of murdering a family of four. Also, a man blames his mother's mental health issues as he sits on trial for killing his own five children. And a prosecutor shares her theory of why a jury convicted a man of driving the wrong way down the highway and killed five teens. Real-life trials are on the Daily Debrief. It's Tuesday, May 28th.
Welcome to The Debrief, everybody. Aaron Keller, along with Linda Kenny-Bodden. Our other guests will join us in just a moment. Testimony entering its second week in the trial of a former NFL player accused of sex crimes involving five women. Kellen Winslow II played 10 seasons with the Cleveland Browns and other teams. He faces 12 charges, some in multiple counts. The maximum penalty, if convicted, is life with the chance for parole. We expect to hear shortly from the so-called Jane Doe number 4, the fourth accuser. But first on the stand, a detective discussed his interview of Jane Doe number 2. On cross-examination, Winslow's lawyers sought to highlight any inconsistencies between her statement to police and her testimony at trial.
And then when she talked about anal contact, she said, quote, she thought that was an accident, right?
She thought it might have been an accident. She didn't know, yeah.
Right. And you documented that in your report, right?
Oh, yes.
And you actually put it in quotes, right?
I put, yes.
And it's important that you put it in quotes because that's actually what she said.
That is correct.
So she thought the anal contact was an accident.
That's what she said.
Right. She described the choking to you, right?
Yes.
She said he had both hands around her neck for approximately 2 minutes.
Her words, yes.
Right. She said that she would have been dead had he done it any longer, right?
I believe so, yes. She was concerned about that, yes.
Right. Did she ever tell you or anyone else that she thought that he did it in a way that it wouldn't leave marks?
I don't recall that statement, no.
As we said, Winslow's accusers are known as Jane Doe's 1 through 5. Three have testified thus far.
When he inserted his penis, it hurt so bad.
That is the voice, and these are the hands of Jane Doe number 1.
Yes, I kept on saying, ow, 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 because I don't know how he fit that thing in there.
The 54-year-old woman testified that she was a transient and was hitchhiking when a man approached her in his vehicle on March 17th, 2018.
And then all of a sudden he goes, I'm not going to take you to Vulcan. I'm going to take you to the store and f*** you.
She went to the police 4 days later despite threats.
He's like, no, no way, I'll kill you.
When you told him to pull over and let you out at the hospital, did he say that he would kill you?
Yes, he said that he was going to get this done.
The account of Jane Doe number 1 led to 3 charges against Kellen Winslow II: kidnapping, forced rape, and forced oral sex. The defense reminded her that she previously identified one of the attorneys, rather than the defendant, as her attacker.
And that's still the person who raped you?
No, it's the one next to you, yeah. Him.
Prelim, you were pretty sure about.
Okay,
right?
Just a moment.
She also failed to accurately describe the suspect's vehicle.
You were fairly positive it was a Jeep because you read J-E-E-P. Remember that? I told the
yes.
Police that. And you were positive that it was a two-door. Do you remember that? Because you told that to the police.
Right.
And you were also positive that there were no back seats because you told that to the police also. You remember that?
Yes, then it must have been a Jeep. You're right.
Authorities found Winslow's DNA on Jane Doe number 1's pants. The defense says sex occurred, but says it was consensual. And the blood Jane Doe number 1 said resulted from the alleged rape?
Yes, I was menstruating.
The blood that we're talking about here was from menstruating rather than being penetrated and assaulted, correct?
Yes, sir.
Still, this Jane Doe says the sex was not consensual.
That's accuser number 1. Now Stacy Delicat brings us the testimony of accuser number 2.
Jane Doe number 2 refused defense demands to look at Kellen Winslow II.
I really don't want to look at him, sir.
Say about
I don't appreciate it.
appreciate what?
That I have to look at my rapist.
Back during the prosecution's case, she described the night she says the former NFL player sexually assaulted her.
He held my hands together.
Tell us what he actually did on the side of the car when you were in the passenger seat.
Well, he had me take my pants off and pulled me on front of the seat and, you know, started to rape me.
Doe number two is a 59-year-old homeless woman. She said she recognized Winslow because he'd often talk to the homeless. But on Mother's Day, 2018, he pulled up in his Hummer and offered her a ride to grab coffee. That's when she says Winslow, who she knew as Kevin, forced himself on her.
So you're being choked by two hands.
It was two hands, and I knew he was smart.
What?
Because he did it in a way that you can't leave any marks. Just the same as him ejaculating outside, sir.
Winslow's defense team maintains the two had consensual sex.
She leaves out the fact that we find out later that we learn that, oh yeah, they did talk about having sex for money. Of course, that comes out months after her original statement to the police.
Jane Doe number two said Winslow previously offered her $50 for sex, but she rejected that offer. She reported the alleged rape the next morning.
Did you believe he was going to kill
me?
Winslow is accused of forced rape and sodomy with regards to Jane Doe number two. He has pleaded not guilty. For the Law and Crime Network, I'm Stacey Delacat.
Jane Doe number three provided her account of yet another alleged crime. Jesse Weber brings us that testimony.
At that moment, I said, no, 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 no. And then I walked away.
57-year-old Jane Doe number three spoke through an interpreter and appeared to be shaken emotionally as she told jurors that a man she believes to be Kellen Winslow II exposed himself on her property in May 2018.
I saw him. I was walking toward the orange tree, and then he was following me. And then he took his pants and then exposed his penis to me.
She testified that a man approached her home a month prior on a bicycle and introduced himself. He told her his name was David and said he lived just up the street. Their second alleged meeting was more troubling.
I said, no, 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 no.
When you saw his penis, was it erect?
Yes.
Did he touch himself?
Yes, he used his hand to hold the penis.
This Jane Doe said she didn't look at her alleged attacker's face because her culture doesn't encourage looking strangers in the eye. She spoke with the police that same day and described the man as dark-skinned, athletic, with curly hair and tattoos on both arms. But she gave the wrong height.
And you said that it was an adult male, 5'8" tall, short hair and medium build, right?
Yes, sir.
Because that's what she told you, right?
Yeah.
The account of Jane Doe number three resulted in a charge of indecent exposure against Kellen Winslow II. It alone could carry a fine of $1,000 and up to 6 months behind bars. For Law and Crime, I'm Jesse Weber.
And again, testimony today involving a lot of law enforcement officers about potential inconsistencies, about a number of other things, including evidence collection. We are waiting for the testimony of Jane Doe number four. Criminal defense attorneys Linda Kenny Bodden and Paige Pate are with me on the debrief right now. So, Paige, let me start with you. It seems like this is a very vigorous defense. The question is it going to be enough?
Well, Aaron, we're going to find out at the end of the day, right? I mean, the defense lawyers in a case like this with so many different accusations, so many different alleged victims, they have to chip away at each story to undermine the person's credibility. Normally, in a sex offense case like this, the prosecution is left with one story versus the defendant's story. And the only way to get past that is with some hard evidence. And I know we've seen in this trial so far, the prosecution has introduced evidence to try to corroborate what these alleged victims are saying about where Winslow was, at least on one of these occasions, to bolster the evidence that they let in from the victims themselves. So we're going to see if the prosecution can piece all of this together, but it is very difficult for a defense lawyer to fight off all these different accusations because of the pattern that it presents to the jury.
Exactly.
Very incriminating. very difficult.
Exactly, I agree. Linda, look, you know, here, and I realize the state has the burden, but look, I mean, you've got a couple of different defenses basically bubbling up. A couple of them are like, oh, well, wait a minute, I did something that was morally bad, but bottom line is it was consensual, she's lying, and then the other ones, I didn't do anything, they're just lying flat out. I mean, so does the jury just look at this and say the defense has lost all credibility because the defense has to spin a different theory to try to get out from under each accusation?
Well, it's difficult, Aaron, because when I look at this case, the first thing that jumps out at me, if I'm a juror, is like, sex pervert here, sitting in that seat there. In this courtroom in front of me. I don't want to look at him either. But then when you start looking at the different stories, we all talked the other day with juror number one, alleged victim number one, and she may be a victim of somebody else, that there were inconsistencies that were pretty monumental. Number two, there were also inconsistencies. The same nurse, the sexual assault nurse, found nothing to corroborate the story. Number three is very credible, except for the fact that the height. I mean, if you're looking at, well, maybe if you're looking at his private parts, you weren't really looking at his height standing up.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, okay, so, you know, I mean, can you really get somebody's height correct when you're worried about the interaction, Linda?
No, it becomes to me like a gun. You know, people in a robbery look at the gun, they don't look at the face of the person. So it's very much like that. I thought she was very credible.
Okay, we're going to move along. We've got a lot to talk about. We'll see both of you later on in the broadcast. A prosecutor in a case we recently brought you live on the Law and Crime Network is speaking about her theories of the case. Jurors convicted Stephen Burgoyne of Vermont last week of murder after he drove the wrong way down an interstate highway and swerved into the path of a car occupied by five high school students. He then stole a responding police car, left the scene, turned around, and drove straight back into the wreckage at more than 100 miles per hour.
There's always been another reasonable explanation that makes a lot more sense than the fact that he thought that his radio was talking to him. And that's what we needed to just really stress to the jury of, like, everybody wants to imagine that there's some reasonable explanation for these things. And anybody who commits murder in some sense has some mental health issue going on or some other reason that they might find was valid at the time. That doesn't make them insane. I mean, the insanity defense is a very difficult burden for the defense. And in some cases, it's a very valid one. And in this one, we just felt like there was a lot of other reasons why he just stole a car and took off. And then when he was trapped, came back. Once I started to prepare for trial and spoke at length with Dr. Cotton and some of the other just legal experts in this field, my theory is that after this occurred, in that moment when he did see these teenagers in the car, his mind immediately started to defend itself. I do think that it was a sort of psychological game that his mind may have been playing to convince himself that he couldn't possibly have done this. Our minds do really incredible things to try to make ourselves feel better about bad decisions that we make, and I think that's what happened.
That prosecutor is weighing her options for a sentencing recommendation. And still ahead on the debrief, closing arguments finally upon us in the case of a California man accused of brutally murdering a family of four. Plus, we'll take you back to the case of a man accused of murdering his five kids as the defense presents a series of additional excuses. That's after the break here on the debrief. Welcome back to the debrief. After nearly 6 months, closing arguments are finally occurring in the California prosecution of Chase Merritt. Merritt is accused of killing the entire McStay family in 2010. Prosecutors say money was the motive. Victim Joseph McStay and Merritt did business together. All four of the McStays were beaten with a hammer. Their bodies didn't turn up until years after they disappeared. Here are some of the prosecutor's key points during closing arguments.
Because we've been here for 5 months, I want to walk us back through the facts a little bit, actually in a lot of detail, to remind you of things that are important, but also to make those connections for you, to understand the significance and an interpretation of them that point towards the defendant being a willful, deliberate killer. It was blow after blow after blow to a child's skull, a three-year-old and a four-year-old. That is an intentional killing. We heard from Michael and Susan that Joseph was running Earth-Inspired Products, a water feature company. But more importantly, we understood that this was a bifurcated business with internet sales
I think Mike called them drop and ship sales, that came in through the internet website that was optimized by Dan Kavanaugh, really run by Dan Kavanaugh. And you actually saw evidence in this case, even through the defense case, that Dan Kavanaugh continued to run that business even after the murder of the McStays, with shipments to Adagio and other water feature companies. But then you had the other side, which was the custom orders. These are bigger, more complex, custom built and designed waterfalls. You also learned that the defendant was being sidelined. And there were several pieces of operative evidence that you may not have connected those dots to understand it as the defendant being sidelined. One is there were project failures. Perveccio, Levine. You heard from David Cicada about having to make up work because the defendant wasn't doing it, or he was doing a sloppy job, or he was nowhere to be found. Joseph was looking for other fabricators and welders type people to do the work.
We are only midway through those closing arguments. You can watch them as they roll along later today on lawandcrime.com. A full recap will be on tomorrow's debrief. Meanwhile, a man accused of murdering his five kids is pressing an insanity defense in a South Carolina courtroom. Timothy Jones Jr. could be executed if jurors find him guilty and agree on the punishment. He admits taking the lives of his children, ages 1 through 8, and then driving around with their bodies in the back of his Cadillac SUV for more than a week. The defendant's grandmother testified that the defendant's own mother had mental health problems, which affected Jones's upbringing.
You know how you cuddle your babies if they cry, you run to them immediately? She didn't do those things. She would let him lay and cry. She would let him lay and urine, and I would have to attend to him. And then she would tell me, I wish he would just shut the f*** up. I mean, she didn't even want to hear him cry. She didn't really want any part of him.
And when she said that, and of course, everybody excuse our language, but when she said she wished Timmy would shut the f*** up, he was an infant.
Yes.
In terms of other things that she did to Timmy when he was an infant, in terms of dressing him and things, will you tell the jury about that?
Oh, it would be 90 degrees outside, and she would put him in flannel jeans and a flannel shirt with a t-shirt. And I'd be telling her, Cindy, it's so hot, he would be sweating. His hair, little hair would be wet with sweat. And she'd say, he needs to be covered. His body needs to be covered. She would bath him in cold water. She would give him laxatives to cleanse his body. She would not feed him because she didn't want a fat baby. I mean, she just let him cry constantly.
Wow. A parade of defense doctors, meanwhile, suggested a brain injury from an old car crash affected the defendant's behavior. But another doctor provided recorded testimony that Jones's underlying mental health condition was exaggerated by drug use.
If someone has an underlying psychotic illness, what can A.B. Panaca do to them?
It will make it very much worse. You might think of, say, an acrobat working on a high wire. This would be maybe the psychotic in some state of balance, going to work, living a life with very unusual thoughts. If the drug then pushes them off the high wire, their underlying illness in this metaphor is made vastly worse. And that exacerbation continues after the drug has left their system. The exacerbation is not simply a matter of intoxication on top of an illness. The illness is made worse by the intoxication. The underlying mental illness is made worse.
Previously in this case, the defendant's pastor testified that Timothy Jones would sometimes fly off the handle or believe very strange things.
You told me in the past the difference between what you said, calm Tim and not calm Tim. Can you explain to the jury that difference?
Tim had two sides. One minute he would be calm, listening, open, engaged. If you said, mentioned something to him, he would hear you, respond to you. But then he had another side of him that once that kicked in, it was very difficult to have any kind of legitimate communication with him. He would say to me sometimes whenever he would start getting frustrated, and it seemed to escalate when pressure was on or what have you, and he would say, it seems like there's a monster inside of me trying to get out, and I don't know how to stop it. When that was going on, it was very difficult to communicate with him, and whatever I would say to him would not often be heard or received, and it was as if almost there's no point in talking at all at that particular time, you know, until he calmed down again.
Back one more time, our criminal defense attorneys, Linda Kenny-Bodden and Paige Pate. So, Linda, let me ask you here, is it drugs? Is it mom? Is it mental illness? Where is the excuse going in this? We know the defendant is trying to say insanity, but at what point does the defendant just keep pointing the fingers at everybody and then it backfires because he runs out of people to blame?
Well, Aaron, it's really mitigation. When you start a death penalty case, you start really with mitigation. So what you're seeing is mitigation coming in through the actual guilt phase of the trial here. And, you know, I just have to say that untreated mental illness is a disease. It's a broken brain. It's terrible. And here we see the result of that broken brain, and the result ultimately was the death of five children.
Okay, but shouldn't the mitigation evidence really come, Paige, at the second part of this case, if we get there? Shouldn't that come in the penalty phase?
Well, pure mitigation evidence, yes, but I do think this evidence is also relevant to guilt or innocence on the insanity issue. I don't think there's a legitimate question that this guy is mentally ill. The question is going to be, is it enough for the jury to excuse what he did? Are they going to hold him responsible because he, you know, simply could have stopped himself even though something's wrong with him? It's just such a high burden to meet on an insanity defense for a defense lawyer that you have to go above and beyond, present the mitigation evidence, show why he's mentally ill, and more importantly, why it's not his fault this happened.
And Linda, look, we've got evidence here that the defendant's searching for places he can run that don't have extradition treaties with the U.S. I mean, so is this one of these things where jurors are supposed to believe, if they believe in the defense theory, that he had these mental health issues, that he was legally insane until right after he killed his five kids, and then all of a sudden he was lucid and he thought about running and going where he wouldn't be caught?
Yeah, Aaron, in these cases, I've seen mental health issues work for the defense advantage when the crime is out of love. You know, I slaughtered my children, as we did in Andrea Yates, because I thought that the devil was taking them over and they'd be better off if they're dead with me. But I don't see that working here. Whether or not it saves them from the death penalty is a different story.
Yeah, this is a strong case for the state. That's my opinion. But look, other opinions may disagree. Paige Pate, Linda Kenny-Bodden, appreciate your insight on the debrief. For those of you watching on the Law and Crime Network, our live trial coverage will continue when courts resume in California. For those of you watching elsewhere, we'll see you tomorrow on the debrief.